Perfect. All right. Hi, folks. Today on Ride On Radio, I have David Hakenson and their new book, Her Place in the Woods: The Life of Helen Hoover. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
I'm happy to be here, Emma. Thank you.
Awesome. So, what I wanted to know about is what made you think about writing about Helen Hoover's biography? What was like the thought process behind that?
Interesting question because I've been asked that by a lot of my friends. Helen Hoover was this sort of beloved nature writer who lived up on Gunflint Lake in the 1950s and 60s, and she was quite successful, best-selling. Wrote four books for the adult market and three for the juvenile market. And at the time, they were all bestsellers. People knew of her. But in the years since then, and since she moved away from Gunflint Lake, her reputation is sort of diminished. And I was looking around after reading her books for a biography, thinking I might find one, and didn't. So I started looking around, thinking, there's got to be more about this woman. And I discovered some material at the Minnesota Historical Society that pointed me to UMD, where her papers were in their archives and special collections. So I took a dive into all of that and was convinced that her story was very interesting and needed to be told.
Awesome. So the kind of follow-up question is like when you went up to the how was the research for this? Like, was it pretty easy to go to the UMD market? Were there any other sources you were looking for while looking into her biography?
Yeah, there were a lot of interesting sources. UMD obviously was the primary resource because her papers are there. But what first got me pointed in that direction was this paper at the History Center in St. Paul. And it was a master's thesis that this woman had written for her MFA at Hamline University. And she was in her 60s when she wrote it. She had passed away. I tracked down her daughter through her obituary, just to see if they had donated her research to a library. And woman said to me, her daughter said to me, I still have all the research, and I'd be happy to let you take a look at it. So I had that. I had what was at UMD, and then from there, it was a matter of pulling in things that I learned about from the UMD collection, which was her publisher was Alfred Knopf, well-known publishing company. All of their corporate papers were in the Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. And so I was able to get a lot of material from that related to her. And then she had some correspondence with some other writers, and one in particular was a science fiction writer who had donated all of her papers to Syracuse University. And they had all of Helen's correspondence with this author in their collection. So I was re really able to sort of pull together this mosaic of information to pull from.
Cool. From those, for like somebody like me, I didn't know much about Helen Hoover at all. I was born in 95, so way past that demographic. And like my introduction to, I want to say like maybe 60s environmentalism is mostly through Rachel Carson in Silent Spring. I'm from Pittsburgh, so like she also went to school there. She has a bridge named after her. So like that's my introduction to that era of environmentalism. And Helen Hoover was just, I don't even know if that was an option until like I moved here or like read about the book. So I'm curious, you've mentioned, I do believe like you read all of her books. When you were reading her books and then doing the biography, what was like the most exciting thing about that? Did you find like, oh, this is what she was writing about, or like more insights to her writing style while doing the biography?
Yes, and the fact that you mentioned Rachel Carson is interesting because they didn't necessarily know about each other, but Helen was certainly aware of Carson, who wouldn't be, because she wrote Silent Spring, and that was sort of a seminal book that launched the whole environmental movement in this country. And that was in 1962. Helen, when she had first moved up to Gunflint Lake in 1954, she had been a scientist in Chicago, and she really was not happy that the county sprayed the side roads with DDT to kill the grass and to keep the weeds down. So she would complain to the county officials threw letters to the editor in the Cook County News Herald in Grand Marais about this. And she also wrote to legislators and also the Department of Conservation, which is what it was called then, and even to her congressman complaining about this, and got some of the spraying to be stopped. And so she was aware, she read the Scientific American, she read some other journals like that. So she was very much on top of what Rachel Carson was doing. But to your question about her writing style, because she had been a scientist and because she loved to write, she had a very good observational powers and the ability for patience. And she had plenty of time to sit in her cabin and watch animals outside their door that they fed with bird seed and other things, and just kind of watch their environment and observe it, and then start to write about the things that she learned. And it wasn't only just looking at things. She got reference books and other things which helped inform her about animal behavior, and that all sort of influenced her writing. So it was very much a, I'm going to tell you about what I saw and what I observed. And I'm also going to remind you that man can't control nature. We have to coexist with it. And that sort of message comes through in all of her books for the adult market, which are each one are a little bit different.
Yeah, and like kind of elaborating on the writing style, what I found fascinating while reading the book was she would anthropomorphize her animals, like Peter the Buck. And I don't know of any contemporary natural scientist who does that. And I wonder if you can elaborate to our listeners more why she did that and kind of how that was different from her contemporaries at the time.
Yeah, and that was particularly from the book The Gift of the Deer, which was her second book published in 1966. And she took that accusation about anthropomorphizing her books very personally and didn't agree with it. I think part of it with The Gift of the Deer, she named all of these deer, and I think people thought that that was sort of, a little bit too sentimental. But when you're trying to describe deer to a reader, you can't say deer number one, deer number two, deer number three. You have to give them names, so, or some way of, ascribing who they are. So she did that. But I think what was important is that if you read between the lines on that particular book and others, she still gets at the core of their animal behavior and observes it and tries to interpret it for humans. And she goes up to that line where, some writers will say that, an animal did something like this that we think about in human terms, but there's no way that they can behave that way because they're not humans. She kind of went up to that line, and I think she masked her ability not to cross it by perhaps just explaining what she saw rather than editorializing on what she saw. So she did get some criticism for it, but she also had her editor who didn't agree with that and asked her to write about that in her third book, which she did in the foreword. And she sort of beat back her critics about that particular topic.
Huh, I never thought about that. One of the things I really like kind of resonated with her story was a woman being in a male-dominated environment, especially being in the metallurgist, I believe is how the
Yes, that's
yeah.
correct.
And I'm kind of curious when doing the biography, writing the biography, did she have like any of like extraordinary insights on being in a male-dominated environment that our listeners would like to know, and like kind of how that shaped her personality and her perseverance?
Yes, I think that's a great question. I think looking back at it, when you look at sort of the birth of the feminism movement, which was often attributed to Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique in 1964, Helen had been working in metallurgy, which is not a women's field at all. It's the study of understanding different properties in metals. And she was working at International Harvester, a big farm implement company. And actually during World War II, she had a series of jobs at testing labs where she learned a lot and was self-taught because she didn't have a college degree. She had only gone to college for 2 years. And I think that, and then landing this really plum job at International Harvester and dealing with this particular problem they had with how steel was treated, and she solved it and had got a patent for the research that she did. I think that was very unusual for the time. And I think because she had a high IQ, even though she wasn't formally tested, it's very apparent through some of her correspondence and some of her self-awareness that she had a high IQ, that she just was not, she just was not aware of sort of the conflicts. And she was sort of above it all, even though the fact that she knew that she was not liked because she didn't have a college degree or an advanced degree, or that she was smart and that she solved this problem, and that she had men and colleagues along the way putting up various roadblocks and ways to sort of sabotage her career, if you will. And once she had solved this problem and got the patent, she felt like she'd accomplished all she wanted to do. And she quit and walked away from that job and decided to move up to Gunflint Lake with her husband and start another career, hopefully, writing. And at the beginning, it was difficult. She started with magazine work and then children's writing. And then it morphed into getting contracts to do books. And she had a really successful second career.
What I really like is also the collaboration with her husband, who was the illustrator for those books, correct?
That's correct. Adrian, I illustrated all of her books.
I think that's just such a cute, that's just a cute couple story. That's like, to me, ideal couples goals.
Well, it was interesting because when they first moved up there, he was supposed to get a contract to do artwork by mail with a client in Chicago. And what happened was they had a car accident. He couldn't get to the appointment in Duluth. He lost the contract, and then they were sort of stuck to figure out what to do. And Helen came up with the idea, because he was an artist, that he could do things like notepaper and stationery that they could sell, that they could produce and sell to like gift shops and others up in that area of the state. And then eventually she placed an ad in one of the nature magazines, Audubon, to sell this stationery. So what they essentially did was ran a mail order business out of their house. And the other thing was, is that the way they reproduced the art on notepaper is that it was done on a mimeograph, and you have to be a certain age to remember what a mimeograph is, but it's a duplicating device and it doesn't require electricity, which they did not have at the cabin. It's done by a hand cranking process. So they were able to do that work by hand without electricity and make a living until, and then at the same time, Helen discovered that she was really adept at writing short stories about animals in the woods near their cabin and in their yard. And she started submitting those to nature magazines, and they started paying her $35 and $50 a throw. And they started to sort of, Adrian had his job and she had hers, and they were both really, really successful with that.
Yeah, I want to touch base on what you mentioned about the lack of electricity in the cabin. I'm kind of curious, how was it writing the biography and learning the hardships of cabin ownership in where they didn't have electricity or running water? And it didn't sound like Helen had a lot of experience experience with this sort of kind of environment. And I wonder if you can elaborate that with our listeners.
Yes, it is interesting. They bought the cabin in 1948, and they spent several summers going up to it, like a lot of people do, spending their 2 week summer at the cabin. When they decided to move there permanently, what they hadn't thought about is you're going to have to live there year round, and they'd never been there in the late fall or winter. So they didn't really think through what they were getting into. And it didn't have running water. They pulled their water out of Gunflint Lake and brought it up to the cabin in buckets. They didn't have electricity. At the beginning, they had an electric plant. It was like a wind generator, but it worked intermittently, and then it eventually didn't work. They did have an oil burning furnace, a small one, and a cook stove, but neither one of them were capable of keeping the house warm all winter at the types of temperatures that you find up at the end of the Gunflint Trail. So, and they also didn't hunt and they didn't fish. So they weren't able to, eat fish or shoot deer and live off of that, because it just was against their principles. So they really were kind of in really naive about what it was going to take to live there. And they encountered a lot of challenges. They had help from some of the neighbors and friends there, but having been two people who lived through the Depression in the 1930s, a lot of people then couldn't rely on anybody for help. There just wasn't help. You had to bootstrap yourself and take care of yourself. And I think part of that sort of survival mentality that they had from the years of the Depression, which were difficult for both of them before they got married, sort of carried over into their life up in the North Woods.
Yeah, I also want to when you mentioned about like working with, because they didn't take any hunted goods or like they didn't hunt or fish. And I remember reading in the book, Helen had as like some confrontations with like the local hunters and around that area. I was wondering if you can like like expand upon why that was and just like kind of the contention that she had with like the local community initially when her and her husband moved up there.
Yeah, they I think one of the things is they started to feed deer and other animals, and the deer would come back, and I don't want to say they were domesticated, but they certainly were going to go where there was a food source. And they did this over several years, and I think Helen talked about it with some of her neighbors. And then the lodges and resorts nearby, which catered to deer hunters in the fall before they closed for the season, certainly were keen on the fact that Helen was feeding all these deer and they were fattening them up. And they had no compunction about saying that there were deer in the area that were being fed by somebody locally. I think what Helen and rightly so was angry about is that their property was posted not no trespassing and no hunting, and hunters just didn't pay any attention to that and went on their land to shoot. It was more of a Wild West mindset back in those days than it is today. It was far north on the Gunflint Trail. It wasn't nearly as developed, so I just think there was less mental restrictions on where people went to hunt. I just think they kind of thought it was the North Woods and everything's fair game. And so when they came onto their property and shot some of the deer that Helen had been writing about, she was very distressed by that, and it really upset her. And really, the fact that so many of the deer that they fed that were featured in the book were eventually shot and killed was really the impetus for her to put that story to paper and write it. And she wanted to do it in a way that, that sort of honored and memorialized the deer in that book.
Huh, that's pretty interesting, 'cause I thought yeah, and especially like the way she immortalized it with like naming the deer, 'cause it always does feel like it's kind of a childish thing to like name like your backyard rabbits,
Yeah.
gophers. There's a raccoon that lives in my backyard and I just like calling him, I think, oh God, I think his name changes every month or so. But it does make it kind of fun though. It's like, okay, there's Glenn again, I guess. I always find that really interesting. But I was going to like kind of bring us back into modern times with Helen Hoover's writing. I'm wondering like what can modern audiences or for those like in my generation, I did not grow up with Helen Hoover. What can we take away from her writing, especially now currently with environmentalism as a more of a upstanding issue now than it was in the
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about nature writing in general is that it doesn't age. We still read Thoreau's Walden. That was written, what, a couple hundred years ago. And subsequent to that, there's been other nature writers, John Muir, Sigurd Olson from Minnesota. There's others that have written about it. Nature never goes out of style. It doesn't change, other than, we are impacted by things like climate change and those sorts of things. But you can still write an observation about deer today, or in 1950 when Helen wrote about it, or in 1825 when Jack London wrote about it. So I think you can, I think the thing about Helen that's good is this sort of through line. That's sort of in between the stories she tells about being very, very clear that man cannot control nature, and we never will be able to do that. And we need to coexist with animals and their environment and our environment in a way that preserves it for the future. So I think if you read her that way, you will find her still relevant, even though there's some nostalgic aspects to not having electricity or running water and things like that.
Yeah, because it's always kind of sometimes I do feel I'm mostly an urban city dweller. So when I always read stories of folks like up in the cabin or things like that, I just never really I sometimes it doesn't feel like it clicks, but I always really like reading the stories of nature writers because it does transport me into those areas and that kind of mindset that makes it easier for me to digest nature writing, quite frankly. That's kind of the thing I always find interesting.
Yeah.
Mind my question, because it's kind of a fun question. Was there a particular book of Helen that you found that you really liked? Of her four books that she wrote for mostly adults? There's
I
one.
think the one that sparked the most was her third book, A Place in the Woods. And that's really the story, the first of her four books. that's more autobiographical. And what it does is it tells the story of them wanting to find a cabin in the North Woods and traveling all over Wisconsin and Upper Michigan and then finally Minnesota and then buying it. And then all the things that I've talked about that they just didn't anticipate. And she does it in a self-deprecating way. So you, as a reader like yourself, who's only an urban dweller, like they were, can kind of, understand where she's coming from. Because I think all of us as humans have a fantasy, that we'd like to just walk away from our jobs and go live in a cabin or go sit on a beach or do something and not have to deal with the modern world and all the challenges that come with it. So I think that book really captures sort of her style and storytelling and nature observation in a way that is really captivating.
I always find it because it does, like, her life just sounds like basically my fantasy of, like, yeah, I'll just quit my job and go live in a cabin in the woods. And it's like, I cannot believe somebody actually just basically did that.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of her appeal is that she and her husband walked away from two very well-paying jobs in Chicago, big city, and did what a lot of people fantasize about doing, and they did it successfully, which I think makes the stories obviously a lot more interesting.
What I'm kind of curious of is what is up, is her cabin still available like for tourism up in the Gunflint Lake, or is there still like kind of a tourism economy around her in that
There
area?
really isn't. I think this book is going to spark one, to be honest, because there's a lot of people I encountered that have, vaguely remember her or know of her from local folklore. But, the cabins, one of them had to get torn down. Another one has been heavily modified and they're in private ownership. So there's really not any way to see them. But she definitely, is sparked some interest. I was just up talking at the Chickwack Nature Center recently, and there was about 60 people there, and most all of them had heard of Helen or knew about her, but hadn't really understood her context in the times that she lived. So that seems to be something that's sort of sparking a reawakening in her in interest in her writing.
Okay, that's perfect. I'm gonna wrap it up here, David. Do you mind reading a little bit of the book? It's from
Yeah,
the last bit of the novel, and David's gonna read us a bit of a section.
thank you. This is from the last chapter of the book. Helen had said she wanted to lead three lives, one in a bucolic small town where she grew up, another in an urban environment where her mind would be challenged by work, and finally, one in a place of peace and solitude where she could write. She accomplished all of these and so much more in the process, carving out her own unique niche among nature writers. She had the ability to connect with her readers in a natural way, and her books were bestsellers in the genre. Reader's Digest would not have purchased the rights to three of her books if she had not have this special appeal. In a sense, her books captured the spirit of the nascent 1960s environmental movement that was stirred by Rachel Carson, which led to a broader desire for a back-to-the-land sensibility, fed by a society yearning to be more connected to nature and removed from the challenges of modern life. Helen's professional life as a metallurgist always had its challenges, especially as a woman working in a field dominated by men. One can imagine how odd it must have been in the 1950s endeavoring to fix a disc harrow problem that had vexed a large agricultural implement company for decades, a problem eventually solved by Helen, a woman, self-trained and without a college degree, and achieved a patent for her discovery. That alone would have been the pinnacle of most careers. But for Helen, it was not. The dream of that young girl in Greenfield, Ohio, to live where she wanted and not be bothered while she read and wrote about what she saw came true. As she said so eloquently in the last paragraph of her final book, The Years of the Forest, I knew that I had found what all men seek, my place in the world of my time.
Oh, thank you so much for that reading, David. This was David Hakenson with Her Place in the Woods, The Life of Helen Hoover. And David, you will be at Majors and Quinn Booksellers Tuesday, September 30th, correct?
That's correct at 7 p.m.
Awesome. So catch David at Majors and Quinn, 7 p.m., September 30th. I believe that will be next week. And thank you so much for joining Ride On Radio. And now this.